everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show, episode number 195. Getting dangerously close to the big 200 there. This episode is brought to you by Environments for Humans Perch CMS Summit. That's the URL as well, perchcmssummit.com. It is coming up this December 10th, and it is all about Perch CMS, which you might recognize because we've had Drew McClellan on the show, Rachel Andrews on the show, their creation, Perch, a CMS for your website. It's a really wonderful CMS, so if you want to learn all about it and level up your Perch stuff, check out the perchcmssummit.com. We'll tell you more about that later in the show, as well as Braintree. The URL for Braintree is braintreepayments.com/shoptalk. And if you go to that URL, when you sign up, you'll get your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free service from them. It's a payments API, a very powerful one at that. We'll tell you more about that later in the show too. But for now, let's kick things off.
Shopomaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front end web design and development. I'm Dave Rupin. With me is Chris Coyer.
That's right, everybody. God, we really nailed that intro, didn't it? Dave couldn't actually hear the theme song that time behind the scenes there, but
flying blind.
We timed it just perfectly, so it worked out. We have a special guest, kind of just a regular old episode, the best kind of episode of Shop Talk Show, where we have a special guest join us to talk about all the cool things that they do and help us answer questions. And that person is Brenna O'Brien. Hey, Brenna.
Hello.
Yeah, I hit it, huh?
That's the sound that we play when we speak with former physicists and mathematicians. It's unique to that character. I got that from the third line on your website. that's the kind of deep research I do about our guests before the show begins. I met Brenna for the first time. Dave and I both did. We're at CSS DevConf, you know, the one that we probably couldn't shut up about, where we all are on a boat together talking about CSS, and we had a good time. Brenna, you were one of the four talks in a row about SVG that day. That was pretty cool, huh?
SVG DevConf, we like to call it.
Brilliant. That's a good summation.
So what's up? You're Toronto, yeah?
I am in Toronto. That is for sure. That's in Canada, if you weren't aware. It's a different country.
I did have to look up which time zone it was in. Canada, I mean.
Yeah, we have one Canada time zone.
It does seem like things are a little bit more efficient up there. And you are at the moment working with TED, like the fancy thing where you like watch videos that like make you smarter, or you know, right?
Yeah. Sometimes I get people saying, "Oh, do you work for TEDx, a local TEDx event?" And I tell them, "No, I work for the mothership, the Big TED."
Oh,
yeah, yeah. Big TED.
This is great. I would like to pitch you some TED Talks, and perhaps you could get me on the stage. Is it now a good time?
Perfect, yeah.
Well, there was a fellow that taught me how to wash my hands on TED.
I did watch that entire video.
Yeah, that was a good one, I thought. But so the bar is, you know, is lowish.
I would like to talk about buying a house from the 1960s and spending a fortune fixing it up. Is that a good topic? Yeah, is that cool. Something that would interest
Seems
you?
Seems a little hyper local.
Okay. I could talk about about ripping a phone book in half.
Oh, is that now we're getting somewhere.
Yeah, it's got a little bit of a show.
What's the hook though?
17 lessons I learned ripping a phone book in half. Is that good?
This isn't Medium. These are videos, but it would work pretty good. But so Brenna, you work at the mothership and as a front end developer at the mothership. Right. What is it like? What's the day to day?
So my job at TED is to actually do a lot of work that sort of supports the machine from the inside. I work primarily on internal tools. So day to day, that has me building Ember apps typically.
No kidding.
Yeah, so I mean, mostly it's things that sort of support the team in various endeavors. One project I work on, I hate to use the word intranet, but it's sort of like an intranet, just a cooler intranet built in Ember, with things like staff directory and like newsfeed, that sort of thing. And
so then, if your intranet is built in Ember, it's cool. Is that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. The word intranet, like, sounds like I should be talking about like cyberspace and things from a long time ago.
It's like a website that's only for internal people, right?
There you go. And the other one I'm working on is pretty cool. It's like a library of all the TED Talks, and it's so that our team can manage metadata, publishing schedules, related photos, that kind of thing. So important work, but nice. Nobody outside the org sees it.
But it'll facilitate the
bettering
of.
Absolutely, there's a lot going on behind the scenes there.
I bet. How many people is it? And it's not in Toronto, or is it?
No, I work. Most of our developers work remotely, so we have New York-based offices where most of the org is. So TED at large, I think, is between about 150 to 200 people. And the tech team that I work on is sitting around 30 people right now.
Pretty good. I don't know much about it other than it's like, you know, I think everybody in the world, they just think TED and they think, oh, interesting videos. They have some kind of event where these videos are recorded. Is that like the, I don't know how much you.
Yeah, that's the crux of it. We're actually a nonprofit, and we're driven by a mission, if you will, and the mission is ideas worth spreading. So the main platform for spreading those ideas is through the TED conference and posting the videos online, but there are quite a few other initiatives like books and like educational videos that all go together to support that in many formats.
Interesting. So, I mean, the tickets are like, you know, that's one revenue source, and then if it's a nonprofit, it might be, there might even be like benefactors and donations and stuff, huh?
Yep. Yeah. The conference is the main revenue stream for us there.
Cool. So, okay, TED, that's pretty cool. And you know, are into other stuff too. It's like, sounds like you're pro JavaScript, you might say.
Yeah, I'm definitely pro JavaScript. I mean, I think a lot of us are pro JavaScript because we're stuck with it. It's the language that runs in the browser. But I think a beautiful thing has happened that because we're stuck with it, everyone just sort of said, okay, we'll make the best of this situation. And the JavaScript community continues to inspire me with putting JavaScript in all the things. It's pretty cool. You know, JavaScript in the server with Node, JavaScript in robots, with things like Nodebots. Everyone is just like, yeah, JavaScript. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah. Do you do Node stuff? I see that you have some, did you help out or are involved with somehow at Node School Toronto?
I've done enough.
Node School, do you write Node at Node School?
I've done enough Node to help other people with beginner Node workshops. But Node School is, even though Node is sort of the primary thing that people learn there, they actually have a really broad set of little things called workshoppers, which are small lessons that people can work on sort of independently with the support of mentors or peers. That cover a pretty wide range of topics, including intro JavaScript, Git, React, all sorts of things like that. So the main, even though it's called Node School and a lot of the focus is on Node, I think the big thing that Node School does is just try to create a sort of welcoming, safe community for people to learn code in a place where they're supported.
Yeah, I think it's fairly common that things aren't end up getting named after one technology, and then pretty quickly it just like it kind of doesn't matter anymore. Like any thing that talks about responsive web design, really they're just talking about all kinds of stuff, performance, and, you know, SVG is certainly on point for anything responsive web design related or whatever, or like, the, you know, there was SaaSConf recently. It's not just about SaaS. It's about the whole world of front end stuff. Or like when people talk, you know, here's a WordPress class. Well, you don't just talk about WordPress. You'd end up talking about the whole stack just because it's just what happens.
I think we're in an interesting time as front end developers and designers where the lines between a lot of things are starting to blur, and we're figuring out what our different roles are and how different languages and communities can be influenced by each other. Just going to both a JavaScript conference and a CSS conference in recent history and seeing how much of both was covered at each conference, I thought was really cool. And it's kind of inevitable that you can't talk about one without the other at this point, I don't think.
I was helping out at this class that ended up choosing to teach Node first because it was kind of a, I don't know, it's, you know, you can teach all these concepts like write a function that does a little bit of stuff and then execute the JavaScript that does it and print out the correct values and stuff. And as you're learning these like simple programming concepts, it's like you're doing it with the JavaScript syntax, but like without the like kind of the complications of the DOM. So it was kind of nice that when they moved over to the browser, everybody was already comfortable with the JavaScript syntax. So it was like an easier transition. It was pretty cool.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. I used to teach front-end development for quite a while, and making the transition from HTML and CSS to JavaScript was challenging. And I think part of the reason is that you get all this visual output with HTML and CSS right away, and then there's all this groundwork you have to do in JavaScript before you actually get to the DOM and get to things showing up on the page.
That's why it was, you know, glory be the jQuery days, because like day one with jQuery, you could be like, we're going to attach a click handler, and the click handler is going to change a class, and then the class is going to change how something looks. And like that was like a really satisfying intro to JavaScript, I feel like.
Totally.
I'm like picturing, you know, like you're teaching somebody JavaScript and they're like, God, oh, this, what a delightful language. And then you're like, now we're going to put it on the DOM or put it into a web page, and just, I don't know, just heads kind of like turning that brooming where you're just like, what? Yeah. That's what I'm picturing right now. Like, it's weird. Anyway, it's weird. It was designed to do that, and it's all very weird.
Yeah, it's a challenging language for many reasons, but I think it's rewarding if you can, you know, learn to use it to your advantage and to kind of, I think it's also rewarding once you get into the JavaScript community, because I've found a lot of really great support from other people there.
And so you're in Ember world, you're in Node world, you gave this talk about SVG, you're kind of into Jekyll and D3. You have a lot of tech interests.
Yeah, I suppose so.
What's the SVG talk all about?
SVG is sort of just even though I don't use a lot of SVG in my day to day, I find it really cool. And I think it's interesting because it's been around for a very long time, yet we've only started to sort of scratch the surface of its full capabilities. And so the talk I gave was just exploring what you can do with text in SVG, because turns out there's a text element in SVG that can just render regular old browser text, but in SVG land, so you get all these amazing SVG possibilities that you don't get with just ordinary text.
I found it interesting in that it was kind of perfect, because you wouldn't show up at a conference and be like, I'm going to give a talk about HTML and just like let that be your talk. Like that would be, it might be a bit much, you know, but like as we're still at the point in SVG where if there's an SVG talk, that's the topic, right? It's like, I'm going to give a talk about SVG, and it's like might be like it's almost just as complicated, if not more complicated, of a language than HTML is. So it might be time. It might be time to start doing
that. It has a lot of weird quirks that old HTML had too. Like things like you need the slash on self-closing tags or things blow up. We thought we were done with that, but not in SVG.
No, not at all. Yeah, you gotta, and it's weird how you can kind of either, you can do either one kind of, which isn't a very HTML-y thing. Like, you know, like a break tag in HTML.
Right.
You, in HTML5, you can just leave it if you want, or you can self-close it if you want, but you can't make a closing tag. That, like, that's not valid.
Yeah.
XHTML2, SVG Rising. The name of
my new movie. I'm writing. So the talk was all about SVG text, which included, like you know, things that kind of work in SVG. And it's like if you're in a browser that supports largely SVG stuff, which... it's hard to talk about because there are so many little parts of SVG that browsers can support and not support. So it's not as simple as does this browser support SVG or not. But, you know, in a browser that generally does a good job with SVG, there's all this stuff you can do that ends up being a heck of a lot easier in SVG than it would be otherwise. Like your demo where you, you know, put an animated GIF in the background of text.
Oh, yeah.
Is that not particularly difficult in a
so happy but. The day that I figured that out. And I've talked about this twice in a conference talk, and I've issued the challenge twice. Somebody please use animated GIF filled text in a production website. I don't know. I have yet to find a use case myself, but I'm just waiting for the day that happens. I challenge you all, Shop Talk Show listeners.
There's a I don't know if this quite qualifies because it's not quite SVG text. But if you go to Tumblr.com and hover over the Tumblr logo, every time you hover over it, it loads a different GIF to like fill the T with. So it's like pretty. It's not like right on, but it's pretty close. It's like it's quite a subtle Easter egg. But the T is just yet more SVG, I think, not actual SVG text.
I did not know about that, and way to go, Tumblr. Of course, Tumblr put a GIF in their logo. How appropriate is that?
So it's really true, though, that there is literally a T-E-X-T element in SVG, and you just plop text in there, which means that it's not like the vector outlines of text that you might think it would be in SVG. It's text just like a span would be.
Yeah, absolutely. You can convert text into a vector, and there's reasons why you may want to do that. But in a lot of cases, just that TEXT element will get you there. And the best part of that is that it's not really a graphic. That text is in your DOM, and so it's completely accessible and screen readerable and search bot indexable.
Yeah, that's the best part, right? Accessible, screen readerable, SEO friendly. You can copy and paste it. You can do Command F and find it on the page.
And it's really easy to maintain and update too.
Yeah, yeah. Although, so there's, but you know, some of the bummer is that like it doesn't wrap, right? So straight up, that could be a pain in the butt. You know, you wouldn't set like a paragraph in it.
No, I think the use case is more going to be for sort of headline flashy text and places where you want to use that lack of line wrapping to your advantage. So
right.
if you want to be absolutely sure that those line breaks happen at the same point, then SVG might be a good choice to make sure that you have a sort of consistent graphic no matter what your screen size is.
Yeah, you introduced them as type lockups, which is great. And I've been working on a blog post about it because I just think it's such an interesting concept that I think would, I don't know, it could take off a little bit more. Knowing how kind of cool and reliable and scalable they are with all the advantages we just mentioned, it's like Definitely. The world should be like be using these more. And then I was like, lockup's just kind of a cool word, I thought.
I had to search long and hard to figure out what to call that thing. And that's the closest I got. I think it's that is an official term in design typography circles.
It is, but it's not, but it's like kind of new-ish. Like I found an article from 2013 where they were kind of, they kind of like were like self-backpedding that they're like, yeah, I like the word lockup. Let's use that kind of thing. Like, so it's not, I don't think it's set in stone, but what is at least not through like screen design. It isn't. But it, as you know, kind of fate would have it, I recently took a little class in Milwaukee at the Bayview Printing Company, and it was just kind of like, come and we'll teach you how letterpress works and stuff. And they have this kind of a whole bunch of wooden type, and we made little designs and ended up printing them and stuff. It was a really fun class, but they use the word lockup too. So as we're like grabbing letters out of wood type and arranging our design, then you put like what's called furniture in between all of the like the lines and stuff, and then you put little other blocks. You have to basically set the type and then fill all the other space with pieces of wood too, because ultimately it all gets clamped together with like a literal clamp, and then you ink it up and send paper across it. So it's literally a lockup of type, and it's like the physical manifestation of exactly what we're talking about, kind of, you know, like certainly text doesn't wrap when it's made out of wood.
I bet someone could make that though.
yeah, probably.
Now that you mentioned it, someone will. Oh yeah.
Well, actually,
I've developed a process called liquid wood.
So is your website Jekyll?
My website is Jekyll, and it's a very old version of Jekyll because I haven't touched it in a long time. But. Fan of Jekyll, I'll say that much.
Yeah. Cool. I was just curious, kind of, because it's one of your interests. It comes up fairly often on Chop Talk Show. And I recently ran a poll at CSS Trick, kind of asking people what CMSs they were interested in, kind of. And it was, you know, WordPress came in number one, you know, and like some kind of not surprising stuff there. But Jekyll was very highly rated on it. And
I used to have a WordPress blog for my own website, and just the phantom empty paragraph tags and stuff that you get. Because I was mostly writing text-based stuff, sort of started to get to me, and it seemed a little heavy-handed for what I was doing. Sure. You know,
it's funny how just one thing like that can turn somebody off of an entire CMS. But I know what you mean. I face little problems like that even today with my WordPress install. Less so much now that you can just one click turn on Markdown and then you're good.
I didn't even know that. I haven't used WordPress in a long time. That's really cool. They are doing some cool stuff.
What span class N3 are you guys talking about?
Just kidding. That's solid. That's a solid joke.
That is deep cut.
Anyway, so Jekyll's still cool.
And I'm a fan of a static site generator for something that's mostly static content. It loads really fast, I think, is a really nice feature of that. And it's...
Yeah, it like can't not. That's the best part of it. Yeah, it's just an HTML file. Loads as fast as that will load.
Deployment is really easily done. I did some fancy things with Git webhooks where it just goes. If I push to the right branch, it'll deploy itself.
It's especially nice when you're using Pages, because then you don't even have to do that. It auto builds your stuff when you push it.
Definitely.
Pretty cool. I think people can take it a little too far. Like I can't not, you know, whatever. There's some baby bear porridge to be had here, because once in a while people are like, I can't believe you're not on a static site generator. You're like, listen, I like static site generators. I think they're wonderful. In fact, I would reach for them as a default tool in a lot of situations because I think the advantages are robust. But you realize that then you don't have a login system. You don't get a comment system for free if you want to add those. Yep. You can't really have forums. You can't really have, like, there's a meal, there's a list I is think, very long of things that you can't do.
I think, like, any tool, it just really comes down to your use case and what's appropriate for it. For my very simple site, you know, I still get people, like, every once in a while, I get a, why don't you have an RSS feed? I love your blog post, but I'm never going to see one again unless you have RSS, which is something that doesn't come for free.
That's the best backhanded, like, put down, like, I really like this, but I'm not going to read it unless you have this feature.
Okay. Maybe exaggerating.
Jekyll can barf one out, can't you? Does your site have RSS?
Oh, or yeah, no? you can do it. You can do it.
Probably. Yeah. But you know how it is with personal sites. I have a very long list of things I'd like to do on that, including redoing the whole thing. So.
Oh, I get it. Your site doesn't, but Dave's is
no, mine does. Doesn't.
It's just, yeah. Oh, I see. There was somebody being rude to you. Jerks.
Yeah. That'll happen.
Maybe RSS should grow up and scrape my site automatically.
I also, people still use RSS? I guess. I thought that
it was surprisingly it was said over 50% of the people read CSS through RSS.
Wow. I wonder what they're using now that, what was the big Google one that shut down?
Reader.
Yeah.
Let me introduce you to the world of dig.com. Travel back to 2006 with me. A utopia of web design and web development and conversation on the web. Dig has a really great RSS reader.
It really is nice. Saying. And it's nice. Me and Dave both heartily recommend it. Cool. So in the same vein is number one, just because you use Jekyll doesn't mean that you can't do anything cool with a database or stuff. In fact, somebody wrote into me and they were talking about, like, there's so much you can do with, like, WebSockets and service workers and Firebase and stuff like that. I'm like, this is pretty interesting that you could use Jekyll and still have, like, pretty, like, modern web features through, like, kind of client-side advanced fancy features. I'm kind of interested in that world a bit.
Pretty cool. Yeah, I haven't looked into it much myself, but it's nice to know that we're always trying to improve our options that way.
I think that would be like a solid class for something like Node School. It's like, come here, we're gonna teach you how to make a personal site. We're gonna Jekyll. We're gonna host it on Pages, and then everybody leaves here with a personal Jekyll site, and you could maintain it through the GitHub interface. You don't even, you know, because you're just editing some markdown files.
Actually, this is sort of going in a different direction, but I had a really great moment with Node School. So the Node School Toronto, I sort of manage the Twitter account, and I got a DM from somebody asking me what the average age was that attended, followed by, I'm 17. Like 17 years old. And so this person was, I think, a little concerned about, you know, being the youngest one there kind of thing. My response
should they
was
have been concerned.
No, not at all. I think the average age group, if I had to like give one, is maybe around 25, but that goes in both directions and everybody is absolutely always welcome there. Regardless of age or skill level or anything. And so, he did end up coming to the event, which was awesome. And, you know, he was a little bit shy and I started talking to him about, you know, which workshopper he should work on. And so I asked, do you have an end goal in mind of what you wanted to accomplish? And I'm like, maybe you can do intro to JavaScript or something. And then he says his end goal is to make his own blogging platform to replace WordPress. And so it's like incredibly awesome, ambitious 17-year-old that made his way to Node School, which I think is just, is so cool. I wish something like that had been around when I was 17.
That is ambitious, and no reason to not let him try, you know?
I was like, here, take a look at Express.
Yeah, sure. At least be aware of that WordPress isn't the only one now. You know, like if you're going to tackle or start having fun with that idea, you should probably have like a pretty good handle on the alternatives already.
Yeah, and I don't mean to be like knocking WordPress at all. It's still a really great tool, and I know nothing about this, but I've heard people talking about WordPress running in Node recently.
Yeah, well, that's kind of where this should go, because this is all kind of related, right? Is that what I know about this is that it's called Calypso, and they just, when they dropped it, they're like, surprise, the entire WordPress.com is already running this right now, enjoy, which is like a pretty baller way to drop it.
Yeah.
But it's not really like, it's just WordPress.com, and it's It's just like this layer on top of your blog. It just like, so there's the WordPress has this REST API now, which like coughs up.
Yeah,
that's anything the other you ask thing. It for.
That's mm-hmm. that's, I think, really great that WordPress can do. You know, it's still, I think it's a valuable tool to use for the admin interface because so many people are familiar with it. And then if you just take like the JSON that it spits out for all your data, you can do whatever you want with it.
Well, that's what they did. This is just a veneer on top of that JSON data, essentially. Like, it's really cool and does a bunch of fascinating stuff and will evolve and maybe be the entire future of WordPress. But I think for now, it's just this nice interface that sits on top of their API.
Really cool.
Like, that's it. And you can't, I think you could probably self-install it, but it's not like a replacement of the self-install WordPress that you already use, at least not yet.
I think a lot of times stuff will land on the hosted WordPress.com and then eventually make its way into the self-hosted. So I'm curious to see where it goes.
I am too. It's kind of fascinating. It would be a big deal the day they said it would be a bigger deal than what they already announced. Not that what they already announced wasn't a big deal, but it would be crazy to be like, okay, this is what we're going to do for all of WordPress now. Because part of the deal is like, it's, you know, WordPress works on like ancient web hosts and has like never deprecated an API and all this like crazy backwards compatibility stuff. And to all of a sudden like really raise the bar really high on what hosting requirements would be to run WordPress and what the build tool situation, like it would be like flipping it on its head. But I kind of wrote in a thing, I think it was a strong move in that, like, I don't know how many more years you can hire a massive team and keep them really excited about working on with the as old of technologies as WordPress is. I think it's probably going to be like easier to staff up and keep staff like happy and productive and doing awesome stuff with a modern stack.
Yeah, definitely. I think so too. Us front end developers are all shiny.
Us? Really? Interesting.
Well, wouldn't it be more boring to work at TED if they're like, well, you're gonna build these back-end internet tools and it's all in .NET and so have fun, here you go, or what? Nothing wrong with .NET.
We're actually in the process of retiring behind the scenes, like the very first PHP monolith that was thrown together when TED was TED.com was like a little baby site.
It's still hanging around, huh?
There's like very few pieces. We're kind of rewriting bits and pieces as we go. It no longer powers like the TED.com website. Most of our backend is in Rails these days. But I know nothing about that.
This episode of Shop Talk brought to you in part by the Perch CMS Summit. So that's what it's called, and that's what the URL is as well, perchcmssummit.com. It's a virtual live conference that celebrates the lightweight, user-friendly, PHP-based content management system. Spend a day with the Perch CMS team, who you've met here on Shop Talk Show before. They are very wonderful, very smart people with a very excellent product. The point of this day is to learn tips and tricks and templating ideas and Q&A with the Perch CMS team. If you register now, which go to perchcmssummit.com to do, use coupon code SHOPTALK for $10 off the conference, which is pretty wonderful. When you attend and go, it's online, so you can attend anywhere in the world. No hotels, no meal costs, no, you know, flight fees, all that stuff. You can attend it from anywhere in the world with an internet connection and a computer. Real-time Q&A. You know, you get these recordings to relive at any time, which is pretty wonderful. Like real-time interaction with the speakers and fellow attendees. The chat rooms are very active at these things. Pretty darn great. So that's perchcmssummit.com and use coupon code SHOPTALK for $10 off. Again, that's coming up December 10th with the whole Perch team. Pretty cool access to that. So what are you thinking, Dave?
Oh, I think we've been going for minutes here. We should head over to the meat and potatoes of the Shop Talk Show. The questions and the answers. First question is from Kevin Lawrence, writes in, let's say I have a menu bar with different icons, and every icon for itself contains different colors, SVG. On hover, I would like to change the fills of these icon colors to pure white. I've solved it with inline SVG, but I'm curious if there's a more elegant way to do that. How do you change icons?
We all met Kevin was on the boat with us too. Boat party.
It's a little boat reunion. That's great.
So, sure. You have, you know, like the icon of a little sandwich and you roll over it and you want to turn it and it's not white. You want to turn it white only on hover. What are the options with SVG?
Yeah, I make a lot of weird things with SVG and don't know how to implement them practically in all cases. But my go-to, yeah, would be inline. The thing with that is I know some people kind of don't like seeing it all in their DOM, but I wonder if in most cases I think you're using some type of templating or build tool. So I would maybe, you know, put it in like a template partial or something so you don't have to look at it or, you know.
yeah, totally. I know.
You know, I mean, kind of. So much of what we do now is going through a build step that I think worrying about, you know, looking at stuff or putting SVG in your DOM isn't that big a deal. Like,
Know. I've always shied away from arguments that include like developers not liking looking at something. I've always been like, okay, this is not, you know.
I don't like looking at jQuery's. So,
yeah, or something like in the web inspector, I see a bunch of noise when I do it this way. I'm like, well, change the web inspector then. You know, like if you should be making decisions based on that.
Or same with like different ways of writing CSS. Like, you know, my class names are really long in BEM. You know, maybe, but I think it's probably worth the trade-off. You know, you have nicely organized CSS. You get hover colors if you put it in line. it's really easy to control your SVG that way.
Right. So the deal is if it's inline SVG, so, that's
good solution, Kevin.
Yeah, exactly. It's elegant. Like there's nothing inelegant about inline SVG, I don't think. Especially if you know, it sounds like you're literally talking about icons. You're probably talking about one big chunk of SVG that sits in your DOM somewhere, but then when you're actually implementing the icon, you just use the use element or whatever. Because they still share the same DOM, you have events that happen. And you can change the fill, and it's no big deal.
I think you bring up a good point with use. That might be a way to clean it up a bit, just to put the cruft of it, you know, somewhere else, you know, the top of the document or something, and then you use the use to make it a little cleaner when you're actually putting that icon there. And then that also allows
really
you to
friendly
reuse
to build
it.
Tools. Exactly. That's right.
I use a lot of SVG use with current color and then just use CSS to change the color. Mm-hmm. And I like that.
There are so many ways to do this though. There, if you really don't like inline SVG or whatever, which would be weird to me, but okay. There's ways that, you know, remember how we used to change, like a sprite color? You just have another version of it in I'm talking about the sprites that are, you know, 25 graphics and you smash them all up onto a 2D plane, you know, and you shift the background around. You could just have SVG can do that as well. That's a kind of a different version of an SVG sprite, but it's totally fine. You could have two copies of it in there and then just shift the background position around to reveal the one that's a different color. The way that Grunticon handles it is they recommend that you just save a second SVG in the Grunticon world, the way Grunticon works is it turns them into data URIs, and the data URIs are right in the CSS file. And they're like, doesn't that straight up double the size of that file? It does uncompressed, but the deal is if you have like the data URI of an SVG of like the sandwich theoretical that we're talking about. It turns into and then you duplicate it, and all you do is change the fill color on the second one. GZIP will turn the second one into nothing, because that's the way GZIP works, is that it sees a mostly identical string, and it just makes a pointer to it. So you could have 300 copies of it, and it wouldn't increase the file size all that much.
I also think, like, perf nitpicks on something like a small SVG icon maybe aren't, you know, you're duplicating a couple K, maybe isn't that big a deal, and you know, especially when we still have gigantic high-res banner images that are, you know, 100K or something. There's bigger fish to fry, I think.
Yeah, potentially. It's worth thinking about. Like, why don't you let the system that you choose handle it for you? Anyway, I'm a kind of unabashed fan of the inline SVG icon system and use it everywhere. And that's one of the things that you get, is the ability to change the fill color on hover. And I love it forever, over and out. Good luck, Kevin. Shoot us some luck on the thing. Steve Polito writes in, I need help understanding why I would need to use a task runner like Grunt or Gulp when using a CMS like WordPress or Drupal. In my case, I'm a Drupal developer. Drupal, along with the boilerplate theme I use, offers the ability to compress and cache CSS and JavaScript. It comes with a compass configuration file for SAS. Also, site users are able to add images to the site via the CMS, which means I can't completely control the image's optimization. Do I need a task manager when using a CMS, or are they really geared towards frameworks more like Jekyll or AngularJS?
Got any advice for
Steve?
Yeah, I mean, I would say you don't need any tool. Unless it solves a problem for you, and if what Drupal's kind of asset pipeline build stuff built in is doing what you need, then sure, just stick with that. I think if you have a problem with it, if you know you don't like Compass and would rather be using something else, then yeah, maybe start looking at alternatives. But I don't think in general we need to jump to using any new tools we hear about just for the sake of trying something new. I think you should come at it with, you know, does this solve a pain point or an inefficiency that I've been experiencing, and look for a better way to resolve those things.
That's the best answer, which is true. I would say, just to like get a little nerdier about it, is that I wouldn't think of Grunt or Gulp as Grunt or Gulp does X, Y, and Z, and that's it. And if your CMS does X, Y, and Z, then you don't need Grunt. Like, it's a little too simplistic, because a better way to think about Grunt or Gulp potentially, or any of the other competitors, these are all task runners, is that a website could have any number of tasks. Concatenating and compressing CSS is a big one of those tasks. Optimizing images is a big one of those tasks. Processing your SAS is a big one of those tasks. But it's not the only tasks that you may need to run. You may want to have, you know, you may want to have developer conveniences like live reload or browser sync. That's a great one. You might have a little setup in your world where every time you like add a file to this directory, it like processes it and it moves it to this other directory and it renames it or something. You might have a little task that does that. Yeah.
Style linting is a great thing that build tools do. Like JS hint or JSCS if you're writing JavaScript.
Yeah, hinting. That's yet another task.
Yeah.
I have an example, real life. I'm using SVG icons from the last question in Day Trip, and I'm using Rails, right? So Rails has this beautiful asset pipeline that compiles all my SAS and JavaScript and crunches it and coffees it and does all these things. But it doesn't like zip up and make icon sprite sheets, right? So and it probably will be Rails 10 before Rails has this feature. So I'm using a task runner. I made just a gulp task one with one. It's a gulp file with one task that just choose through my icons and spits them out.
Right.
And that's
and all. Now that you have that in there, you might be like, you know what? I already got Gulp going. So you know what? I think I want to start writing in some fancy ES6 features. So I'm just going to throw Babel in there because Babel will process it down and then I get that too.
Totally.
And you know what? I want to, just because once in a while, I want to have a grunt test that just finds every single image in my entire project and makes sure it's optimized. You know, like, why not? Now that you have Gulp going, it's like, you know, there's literally, what, tens of thousands of plugins that you can kind of pick and choose for it. So like, don't think of Gulp as like, it's a thing that compresses your CSS, you know? It's a thing that can do anything for you.
Yeah. I think there's something to be said for kind of healthy ecosystems. You know, there's a lot of people writing tools for Grunt and Gulp now that almost anything you need to do is probably there. And I will add to what Dave said by saying that TED.com is also a Rails app that we've replaced the asset pipeline with Grunt, I believe.
So yep.
There you go.
No, I think that's a very common thing. It's like all of a sudden you're just like, well, like, I, you know, my site would compile faster actually if I use this totally node-based thing. You know, there's, I don't know, it's kind of like a, at some point there will be a tipping scale where like, oh, this is a gain for me, I should do this. But it might be a while before you see it. And I wouldn't necessarily just adopt new stuff just because new stuff is cool. That I would also caution that. But so if Drupal's working for you, Steve, I would keep doing Drupal. But I think at some point there's kind of a tip where it's like, oh, this is actually faster and more usable, and I just deploy static assets and life's a dream.
And they're not mutually exclusive. I promise you there's people building with Drupal that have a Gulp build tool too. There's they don't need to be exclusive of each other.
Can we start calling these Frankenpilers?
Absolutely.
Okay. Everyone, go tweet about Frankenpilers.
Frankenpilers it is.
All right. I did. That was my one contribution to the web this week.
A big thanks to Braintree for sponsoring this episode of Shop Talk Show. Braintree is code for easy online payments. If you're building a mobile app and searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. The URL there is braintreepayments.com/shoptalk. Their V.0 SDK makes it easy to offer multiple payment types. So PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, credit cards, of course, all that stuff in one API. It's a very powerful one. It's super easy to integrate. You can integrate it within minutes. They have SDKs in 7 languages, which are .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, Ruby. That covers the internet, I would think, for the most part. 10 lines of in-app code gets you this integrated. If you don't have time to figure it out, think about it, whatever, give them a call. They'll handle the integration for you, literally walk you through it. So pretty darn cool. They have elegant code, clear documentation for all of this. If you go to braintreepayments.com/shoptalk, you get $50,000 in transaction-free transactions, you know? Charge goes through, they don't take a cut for the first $50,000. Pretty significant stuff there. Check them out again, braintreepayments.com/shoptalk.
All right. Inigo Grimbergen writes in, my name is Inigo, and I have a professional self-taught, I am a professional self-taught web developer. I'm sorry, Inigo. I am having the hardest time not doing the Inigo Montoya thing. Okay. But I'm going to get through this. Okay. I develop websites using MySQL and PHP, and of course, HTML, CSS, and JavaScript on the front end. For web applications, which involve a lot of data manipulation, I use PHP MVC frameworks like CodeIgniter or Cake. Recently, I noticed the development of a new JavaScript-based frameworks like Ember and Angular. I started a test project in Ember just to get the feel for this technique. It turns out as a single-page application with less requests to the server, but it's more trouble with routes and the back button. I wonder what are, in your opinion, the pros and cons of JavaScript MVC versus server-side MVC, and what are the typical use cases for one another? And I think I have a sound effect just to kind of polish off this little question. Go on.
Saw that coming.
Brenna?
Oh, boy. It's a It's a big question and a lot of questions.
You probably have more Ember experience than either of us do. But so what's
sure. Yeah. I mean, I think to repeat myself, you know, it comes down to the right tool for the job sort of thing. I think
pragmatism. I'm just
leading off with that. Hold on. Okay. Get into the meat real soon. So I think front end frameworks solve a lot of problems for us. They're not perfect, and there are going to be downsides. But when you're dealing with a web app type thing, I think, you know, versus a website. So if you have a lot of app-like behavior where a lot of stuff has to change on the page and change quickly, it might be better to do that, you know, client-side without an additional server request, right? Just, for example, you have a list of products or something. So maybe your server request, if you're using a single-page app, is to get, you know, most of the products and then... if it's not a gargantuan list, you can get them all at once and then do all your filtering and sorting really quickly on the client side, because that doesn't have to make a trip back to the server. So, you know, something like that is very much like a web app in my mind.
That feels like a UX choice kind of thing. Like you think, oh, you know, it's just going to feel nice for the customer to use this because, mm-hmm. you know, they're looking at products, they're scrolling around really fast, they totally. Add one to their cart, and a little cart pops up from the bottom, they go to checkout, and it's just boom, they're instantly at the checkout. Is it always true that a JavaScript kind of MVC world is just kind of like feel a little snappier than a server side?
For the most you know, there are still performance things that happen. I've run into, I absolutely love working with Ember, and I think it's extremely appropriate for an app. And I wish I could follow up on the question about like the back button not working, because Ember has a really fantastic router that handles history and back button.
Yeah, that seemed like a weird well dig at Ember. It's like you'd think they'd have figured out the back button.
Yeah, I haven't run into problems with that. I have run into some issues with like slow render times, because a lot of front-end frameworks will, something changes and they have to re-render a lot of DOM, and that's a bit of a pain point, but it's something that, you know, the core team is aware of and working on, and, you know, I'm putting my eggs in the basket of front-end frameworks to continue improving and continuing to help us, you know, solve the problems that we need to solve. Yeah. Does that answer all that?
It does. I think Inigo, kind of good luck with that. I think we made some points you could go with. This is too big of a topic for us to just gloss over and give you an answer. So hopefully that was enough for you.
I mean, if you're building like a you know, a landing page or something, just probably a regular site is fine.
Yeah. Well, if you're using CodeIgniter and Cake, like an MVC framework, I mean, you're already kind of set up for the you know, REST API that Ember or mm-hmm. Angular would kind of depend on. It just seems like, why not try it? But I mean, there's a whole host of issues that come with the JavaScript MVC.
I'm so confused. You still need server-side APIs for this all to work, right? And Ember doesn't necessarily prescribe one of those, does it?
No.
But you like build a little Ember app, like just like it's a separate folder, it's like just a little Ember server that fetches data and stuff. And then what's cool is I saw a talk by Ioane Echikuchu, who he just talked why he liked Ember from a developer perspective and why he liked Ember from a designer perspective. And it was amazing. I mean, it was basically just using the Ember CLI. It was like Ember install it was like Ember install Hotfire or something. And then all of a sudden every view transitioned, like his like more or less like static website that
probably
would just
Liquid
like
Fire. I thought Liquid you were Fire. Just picking Fire at random, but Liquid Fire was actually a nice it's a kind of a transition and animation add-on. It's really great.
So it just it like one like command line thing, and all of a sudden all your pages kind of like can like fade in and slide.
Yeah.
Like if you think like Windows 8 animations or something, just like, just boom, like suddenly.
I think that's the power you get when you're working with a framework that is fairly strict in how you use it, right?
Yeah.
You write plugins like that, like there is it a has way a, that views get rendered.
A super healthy add-on ecosystem that, you know, most stuff, you know, is there. And with CLI also you get a lot of, you know, it's easy to install stuff, but it's also easy to kind of scaffold and generate your files. So like if you need a new component, you just type ember generate or ember g component and the name, and it puts all the files in your project directory for you and the server. And so going back to the build tool thing, you know, there's a broccoli file in there, but I don't have to author any of it. It, for the most part, just kind of comes for free. And it's really refreshing and nice just to know that that's taken care of and not spend my time authoring, you know, build stuff, just because it's all standardized and conventional and already there for you.
Hmm. Broccoli being the gulp kind of competitor, right?
Yeah, there's so many of them.
That one looks cool. Yeah, so I like the broccoli.
I've written like one line of broccoli, maybe. like it really does it all for you.
So just because this is all related to this, and we might as well keep interesting topics kind of on point here. There was a Dave weighed in on this cost of frameworks conversation that was happening. Ooh. Recently, right? So it was in, because Ember was kind of related to it as being one of the wasn't it possibly the slowest?
Yeah, we can back up. Like, so Jake Archibald wrote a post.
It was Paul.
Paul Lewis. Hi, those they're interchangeable, but yes. No, Paul Lewis wrote an article, the cost of frameworks, and kind of like just basically made the point, like with data and everything, that just even like bootstrapping an MVC framework kind of puts you out of a performance budget. And just because like it takes so long for the like the data to, you know, you get the thing, you execute the JavaScript, then you fetch the file, the JSON, and then you execute on the JSON, then you render the paint, you know, like that time is probably long enough that it blows you out of a like a strict performance budget. And so Paul just makes this point, and then he put a chart with all these different, you know, MVC frameworks, and Ember was about an order of magnitude slower or half order slower than everything else. And so I think that caused Tom Dale to write a rebuttal post. And Tom's major argument was this keeps teams together and on a task because they're coding with conventions and not just spaghetti laid out on the table. And to-do MVC is not a very great example because it doesn't, that was the example that Paul used. To-do MVC just is, it's a single model. You get none of the like code repetition benefits that Ember would probably save you in a real world situation. And any JavaScript app at, with, you know, seven models and user authentication and all that, that's going to be that's going to be 400K of JavaScript, no matter how you slice it. So like having this like 41K of vanilla JavaScript isn't actually representative of probably everyone else's situation. I thought that was a really good point. And in my experience, using frameworks actually super helps you like make decisions faster and build a product faster. So I agree with Tom there. I had some kind of criticisms of some of his arguments, like devices aren't just getting faster. We've kind of hit the end of Moore's law. Even people at Intel kind of say that. So this idea that, oh, phones will just keep getting better probably isn't true till like 2020. We're kind of stuck at this level for a while. So that's something, you know, that's a big thing. And I never hear any framework ever met, like they never consider mobile bandwidth as like a limitation. They just kind of say, oh, it'll get better. And I like watched a whole React talk like hour. I spend an hour watching this React talk. I'm like sold. I'm in. Somebody from the audience asks a question. What about mobile performance? And they're like, we'll get to it. And it was just like, what? Like, that's not on your mind. It's the year 2015 and you're not like even thinking about it. I think that's a major blind spot for everybody.
Well, what if you're working on an intranet?
Well, I mean, you could make cool intranets. I mean,
we actually are trying to get it to, you can use it on your phone. Just to go back, I do think Tom kind of nailed it, though, and with the idea of it, standardizing working on a team. And to me, the benefit far outweighs, like, the drawback. We have three of us on the team that are primarily Ember developers, and we're literally able to step into each other's projects with very little background knowledge and help each other out and pick up an issue here or there. And I think that's in large part due to Ember's convention and structure. And that really does go a long way when you're working on a team. And something that we've been starting to do more recently as well is Ember is very component-based, or, that's an important part of Ember, which I think everyone's kind of going that way. Component, all the things, but starting to extract common problems and common UX elements across projects, and then building, an Ember add-on that can be reused in multiple projects. And again, because this is all conventional and standardized, you can, essentially write less code and work more efficiently. So I think that's a big thing, especially when you're dealing with teams. And, frameworks came up to solve a particular problem, and that was like messy spaghetti code when writing a fairly complex front end app. And, I think we can like check that box, and hopefully they, like you say, we'll start moving on to things like improving performance.
Well, I mean, it's not hard to imagine it, like stepping into somebody's jQuery plugin, like eight lines of jQuery versus like 300 lines of JavaScript. Like, I know which one gives me the like meat sweats. It's I'm going to have to read this whole thing and then start back at the top. Like, that's how I feel when I open like a really like non, like totally whatever framework or list piece of JavaScript. So I don't know. It's not hard for me to imagine like stepping into somebody else's Ember component. You're like, I'm good. I got it. I know what all these things mean. This is easy. But the mobile performance is a huge consideration, especially if like the web has to win or the, things have to be fast. And that's what Google and Paul and
Tom
all
made another
people.
Point, right? That if you don't choose any framework, any convention at all, that you, over time, if this thing sticks around, you're probably going to develop what he called a Franken framework, right? Which is
Did he steal my word?
it's like a Franken build tool, but a Franken framework. That the chances of performing worse are pretty high. I mean, that's conjecture, but still, like, right. I could imagine that your own little guesses at what's more performant than the next thing is probably not going to be as good as a project who has that at least somewhat of a priority.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a compelling alternative, I guess. I'm going to acknowledge the problem, but await a better solution. And right now, a framework is a good solution for me, I think.
I mean, we hit on all the big points. Like, it's teamwork and stuff. And there's a cost to frameworks. Of course there is. I mean, that's how the whole conversation was framed. Yeah. But the cost has benefits. It's not all negative. Of course it's not all negatives. Otherwise, nobody would use them. It's mostly positives.
Well, for me, there's this like from the other end, it's like, I know how to make a fast website, and it's doing a bunch of stuff. And it's like kind of becoming a burden. And like that, it takes a week to like get a site ready for launch, and that's like a lot of time. And, but, there's also this other argument, like Zach Leatherman, you know, and Tim Cadlec and people are making, is the user doesn't care about your developer convenience, you know, and that's
that's fair.
That's a fair.
Well, they do if your site shuts down, you know.
Right. I mean, that. Yeah. I guess. What? Yeah. What if your site breaks and it takes you weeks to fix?
I will say that, you know, framework or not, I think that we do need to take performance seriously, because, and I think we're coming around to that, but if for so many people, I think, and for a long time, it was an afterthought. Like, you build a thing and then you realize it's slow and go, oh crap, how do I fix this? And, you know, I think the idea of having a performance budget is good, and, you know, just trying to be cognizant of it no matter what solution you're going with.
All right. That may be all we have time for. We're going into, Dave posted a little picture of speaking of the meat sweats, that little turkey you posted has been meat sweating now as it does its little dance. And I can't look at it anymore. So we have to close this down.
I guess that's our pro tip for the week. Hop into Skype, check out Skype emojis. They're a little over the top.
Or don't.
You two can watch a dancing headless chicken for an hour.
Yep. This could be your life. Well, Brenna, thank you so much for being
on. Think about girl shopping. Let's not go there yet. Go carry forward.
Oh, the emoji? Yeah, that's a
walking and carrying some bags.
Swings those bags, wearing a fashionable scarf. So, Brenna, thank you so much for coming on the Shop Talk Show. We really appreciate it. If people aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that? And then what's one thing you'd like to plug before you leave today?
Oh, boy. So I am on Twitter. Pay close attention. Do you have a pen ready? It's my Twitter handle is all the vowels in my name. Or sorry, all the consonants in my name. It's BRNNBRN, or Burn, as some people like to call me. Sorry, what was the second thing? Shout out?
How do people give you money? And then what's your shout out?
I don't know how people give me money. If I do some like speaking engagements, if you want to pay me to do that, you can get in touch. My email is on my website. That's a way to give me money for sure. And last one.
What was one thing you'd like to plug before you leave the show today?
Oh boy. This is
your last hurrah.
Okay. The last hurrah is that, Ted is looking for awesome people that also happen to write JavaScript, to come work with me and the rest of our team. So if you're interested, please do get in touch.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And this was a lot of fun. It was like reliving our time on the boat. I really appreciated it. Thank you very much. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Follow us at Shop Talk Show on Twitter. Subscribe in your podcatcher of choice. Star, heart, favorite that up, because that's how people find out about the show. Really, our listenership revolves around you. You, the listener. So really appreciate you guys taking time out of your day and your commutes to listen to Shop Talk. Hopefully it's a benefit to you. If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs.
I want to tell you about a pretty cool job opportunity here. It's at Home Chef, which is homechef.com, which is this really cool service where, you know, people sign up and they send you ingredients and recipes to make mealtime better, healthier, more special kind of thing, make, you know, eating easier. I love the service. It's amazing. But more than that, you can work there. They are looking for a senior UI engineer. You will be working with the design director to bring cohesion to their digital properties in the interface, as well as in the code base itself. I like how they talk about that. That's pretty great. So, you know, you should be and have familiar with and have opinions about current approaches to building websites, such as using pattern libraries, atomic design, progressive enhancement, graceful deprecation, resolution independent graphics, all the stuff we love and talk about at Shop Talk Show. To apply for the job, follow the link in the show notes for this this podcast, and we'll get you to the job listing page that talks about applying.
for it. So pretty cool. It looks like the website at the moment is a Rails shop. So Haml SAS CoffeeScript. The mobile application uses AngularJS, which, you know, if you care about the tech stack, that's pretty cool tech stack. But, you know, I think you'd be more interested in the fact that it's this great service in Chicago, Illinois, and you can get on board and help them out. Homechef.com, and find the link to apply in the show notes for this show.
We got new shirts that, like, they're the same shirt, but we, like, refined the printing of stuff a little more. So the Shop Talk Show logo looks even better on them. Go to check that out at shoptalkshow.com/store. And we have men's and women's shirts available for sale there.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening. Chris, you got anything else?
Shoptalkshow.com.